This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're very grateful to have Medea Benjamin with us to tell us about the new developments of AI technology supported by the U.S. and Israel to create kill lists which target individuals to be assassinated.
She co-wrote a terrific article called A Brief History of Kill Lists from Langley to Lavender. Medea speaks with us as the head of Code Pink, even as she's been lobbying Congress and is in Congress today.
We'll also speak about the trend across America to abolish capital punishment.
Mike Farrell, president of Death Penalty Focus, joins us to put a human face on the deeply flawed cases that expose glaring errors in the capital punishment system.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Two artificial intelligence systems are being used by Israel and the United States to compile kill lists of Palestinians in Gaza. They're called Lavender and Where's Daddy? This has led to the indiscriminate slaughter of whole families and has killed mostly women and children. The CIA and the U.S. military have always tried to use the latest data processing technology to identify and kill their enemies. The history of American government assassinations goes back to collaborating with ex-Nazi intelligence officers after World War II. We speak today with Medea Benjamin about her recent article in the L.A. Progressive, co-authored with Nicholas Davies, called A Brief History of Kill Lists from Langley to Lavender. Medea Benjamin is a co-founder of both Code Pink and the international human rights organization called Global Exchange. She's been an advocate for peace and social justice for more than 30 years. Her latest book, published by OAR Books, is War in Ukraine. Medea Benjamin, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Nice to be on with you.
Medea, before I ask you about Lavender and the other kill programs, just tell our audience a bit about where you are now that we're speaking. Where are you?
Oh, well, I'm sitting in the hallway in Congress. Today we are visiting the nine members of Congress who chose on this recess to go to Israel, paid for by AIPAC, to meet with Benjamin Netanyahu, to meet with the defense minister, Gallant. It seems that they feel that this is the way that they should spend their time instead of back in the district dealing with their constituents. And I want to say that this is led by Steny Hoyer, and this is his 21st trip to Israel leading congressional delegations.
That's impressive. Now to the main topic of our interview. Lavender is a new AI system developed by Israel to create kill lists. What essentially is it, and how does it work?
Well, thanks to an expose done by an Israeli online magazine called Plus 972, we have a detailed report that shows Israel's use of this artificial intelligence system. It's called Lavender, and it's used to target tens of thousands of Palestinian men in their bombing campaign. At one point in the database, they had 37,000 men who they said has suspected links to Hamas or to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. How do they get this list? Well, it's a numerical score that's based on cell phone and social media data that they add these up, and according to the score, that's the where they stand on this kill list. Now, according to their own testing, they said at least 10% of the men chosen for assassination have only an insignificant connection with Hamas or none at all.
Medea, Israel has another automated kill list called Where's Daddy? Explain that one and what are the problems that it raises?
Well, first, let's recognize how disgusting it is that they named it Where's Daddy? Because they use this list to bomb the homes where these men are, and of course, their families along with them. You know, I have been to Gaza many times after their incursions in 2008, 2014, etc. And you could see in some cases what are real precision bombing, in that they can take out a room. They can be so precise that you can see the entire building standing except for that one room that the bomb hit. They're not doing that anymore. They are taking out entire apartment buildings. And so this Where's Daddy list tells them where the person they're targeting lives, and they bomb that house or that apartment building instead of going after this person during the daytime when they're out and about doing whatever they're doing. Waits for them to get home. Where's Daddy then targets and kills them in the residential area along with their wives, their children, their neighbors, their relatives, etc.
Nadia Benjamin, you write that the CIA and the U.S. military have always tried to use the latest data processing technology to identify and kill their enemies. Could you talk about this, please?
Well, yes. I mean, certainly the CIA didn't always have computers and wasn't able to help countries like Israel generate these kill lists, but they always tried to have the latest technology. And in fact, some of the methods they learned from the German intelligence officers who were captured at the end of the Second World War. And those Nazi kill lists were generated by this intelligence unit that didn't have computers but did have access to millions of Soviet prisoners of war from all over the USSR and had no compunction about torturing them to learn the names of Jews and communist officials that then the Nazis could go after. After the World War was over, the United States then flew senior members of this intelligence unit to the United States to meet with the CIA and then send them back to Germany to resume their anti-Soviet operations as, guess what, CIA agents.
Now, these killing systems actually are even more extensive. They go back to the post-World War II era. Weren't there lists compiled to kill people in Guatemala and Iran in the 50s? In Chile, Indonesia, and Vietnam in the 60s, and across Latin America with Operation Candor. Tell us more about those efforts, and are Lavender AI and Where's Daddy an outgrowth of these earlier systems?
Well, yes, there is a whole history of CIA operations to assassinate large numbers of individuals. We can go back to the CIA coup against Mossadegh in 1953, where the CIA team, led by Major General Norman Schwarzkopf, trained an entirely new intelligence service. You might remember SAVAK as one of the most brutal intelligence services that tortured thousands of people, that was used as a way to purge Iran's government of suspected communists. The same is true in Guatemala with the CIA coup in 1954 that replaced the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz and led to a brutal dictatorship that went on throughout the 1960s, where the U.S. helped the Guatemala army in this scorched earth campaign to kill over 15,000 people. In their effort to defeat a few hundred rebels, they killed many, many, many thousands of indigenous people in Guatemala. And then the CIA trained the death squads. You are probably familiar with the School of the Americas, where the U.S. was training people from not only Guatemala, but from all parts of Latin America. We have the example in Indonesia in 1965, where General Suharto seized power and the U.S. Embassy compiled a list of thousands of communists for his death squad, and the CIA estimated their own estimates that they eventually killed about 250,000 people, while others say that over a million people were killed in Indonesia. And then we have the Phoenix program in Vietnam, that was designed to dismantle the National Liberation Front shadow government from across South Vietnam, and they fed the names into an IBM computer along with their locations, and this led to the killing of over 25,000 NLF officials with the CIA support. And after the defeat in Vietnam, the CIA continued to engineer coups and expand on the way that it collected these kill lists, including supporting Pinochet's coup in 1973 in Chile, and then creating this Operation Condor that was used throughout Latin America as an alliance between right-wing governments in several Latin American countries, including Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, to hunt down tens of thousands of political opponents. And this led to the disappearance of tens of thousands of people and to, quote, perfecting the CIA's ability to find and hunt down people that they considered communists, dissidents, and political opponents.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Steve Rohde. We're speaking with Medea Benjamin about the use of kill lists in Gaza. Medea, in Iraq, cell phone information was used instead of human intelligence to target people. Did this result in many more killings of innocent civilians, killings that are known as collateral damage?
Well, yes. In this case, the operation was put under the command of General Standy McChrystal, who oversaw the development of this enormous database that was used both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, using these cell phones. And what we saw was a huge flood of innocent civilians that were killed. Now, you might remember that under the Obama administration, in the case of Iraq, there were weekly meetings that they held. They called them Terror Tuesdays, in which they would select who would be killed, and this was by drones. So this was not just happening in Iraq, where there were indiscriminate killings, but these Terror Tuesdays were hunting down what they considered terrorists in several different locations, including Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. I visited Yemen and Pakistan with delegations of Code Pink to meet with the family members that were killed by U.S. drone strikes from these Terror Tuesday lists that were compiled using cell phones and just data that was collected by the U.S. government, and found that there were reports saying that 90% of the people killed in Pakistan, for example, were innocent civilians. So these databases, this use of telephones, whether it was in Iraq or in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, led to the deaths of many, many thousands of innocent people.
Taking a bigger picture, have we now come full circle from a Holocaust perpetrator during World War II by the Germans to one now perpetrated by the Israelis with American support against Palestinians? How did we become this country that supports genocide? How does it have to do with the fact that Israel is a pillar of U.S. domination in the Middle East?
Well, as we've just spent time talking about, the U.S. has a history of supporting dictatorships, of supporting regimes that the U.S. considered allies, even though they had horrific repression inside their own countries, and this is the case, of course, for Israel. Now, Israel might have been at one point a, quote, strategic ally, but is now considered by many to be, as Professor Mersheimer has called it, a strategic albatross, that it doesn't benefit the United States in any way anymore. But now there is this huge lobby, the AIPAC lobby, the Christian Zionist lobby, as well as the military-industrial complex lobby that makes so much money from U.S. support to Israel. you know, even before October 7th, we were giving them $3.8 billion every year. Most of that went back to U.S. weapons company. And AIPAC has been lobbying for that money for Israel for a long time now and built up a very strong lobby that puts the fear of God into these halls of Congress where I am right now. So people are afraid to speak out against the Israeli oppression way before October 7th, and since then have watched and participated in and authorized more money for this genocide that is taking place. So I would say part of the problem is the U.S. subservience to a military-industrial complex for quite a long time, and part of the problem is the Zionist lobby, whether it's Christian Zionist or Jewish Zionist, that have taken hold of our system.
So, Medea, what does Code Pink propose that we do to resist all of this?
Well, it's a big monster to resist. In the case of AIPAC, more and more people are starting to recognize how AIPAC is a cancer on the U.S. system. It is now putting $100 million into this upcoming elections and trying to take out anybody who has expressed support for the Palestinian cause. And there is a campaign now called Reject AIPAC of several different groups, including Jewish groups. Code Pink has a campaign to reject AIPAC, as well as other Zionist groups that are supporting the Israeli slaughter. And we are trying to make it clear that taking money from AIPAC now is taking dirty money. And so there's a campaign to try to get members of Congress to pledge not to take AIPAC money, to show that this money is just going to make our system less and less democratic. There's also efforts to fight the impact of the military-industrial complex, to try to get communities to divest from the weapons companies, to expose what these weapons companies are doing to keep us constantly in wars. And so those are some of the ways, and I would encourage people to look at our website at Code Pink to find out more ways that it can get involved.
Looking at another region in the world, the United States and NATO have increased the number of nuclear weapons. They've extended the number of NATO troops to 500,000. Draft registration laws in the United States have been changed. Secretary Blinken is bragging that under Biden, NATO countries have increased military spending by 18%. Please talk about this buildup and its consequences.
It's so important that we talk about NATO, because I think most people in this country have no idea that NATO is not a defensive alliance, it's an offensive alliance. We can see its history in places like Yugoslavia and Bosnia, support for the U.S. invasions in Iraq and Afghanistan, the invasion of Libya, and most recently in the case of Ukraine, where it's actually the threat of Ukraine joining NATO that has been one of the main reasons why Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm not condoning the invasion, but I think we have to look at the buildup towards it. And so when we look at now Blinken bragging about NATO countries spending more money, that is indicative of NATO looking around the world and seeing three possible war fronts. NATO is involved with the U.S. in Ukraine that could easily become a more regional war there. We've even heard Macron talking about sending in European troops. In the case of the Middle East, NATO is in partnership with Israel, working very closely, and that is a area that could easily also become a regional war. We see what's happening now with Lebanon and Iran and Iraqi paramilitary groups, Syria. And then there's the big one, which is China. And even NATO, as well as the U.S., look at China as their main adversary. I think in many ways that's the cherry for the military-industrial complex that sees it as the big enemy where they can make the most amount of money. So I think it's an incredibly dangerous time when we see NATO and the U.S. looking at three different war fronts. And let's not forget that we're talking about, in each place, nuclear powers. So there's a lot for us to do to try to dial down all of these conflicts and to move us from a war economy to a peace economy.
Medea Benjamin, unfortunately, we're coming to an end to our allotted time here, but I wanted to ask you before we have to let you go, how can our listeners stay in touch with you and your work and contact Code Pink?
Well, one thing I can say is that during this conflict in Gaza, Code Pink has grown tremendously, and we now have chapters all over the country. We have a huge increase in members, supporters all over the country, and we encourage you to join us. You can reach us online at codepink.org. We have regular webinars with lots of good educational material. We have actions that we ask you to take on a regular basis. So yes, please go to the website, join us, be part of a growing movement to say no to war, yes to peace.
Medea Benjamin, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We respect you. We offer you our solidarity, and we're going to want to have you on again. Thank you again.
Okay, great being on with you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
A growing number of states have abolished capital punishment in recent years. However, the death penalty remains on the books in 27 states, although the number of executions in America is at an all-time low. It's well documented that the death penalty is riddled with fatal flaws. Literally, the flaws are denying defendants a fair trial and are killing innocent people. An average of 4 wrongly convicted death row prisoners have been exonerated each year since 1973. According to recent research, jurors are 3 times more likely to recommend a death sentence for a black defendant than for a white defendant in a similar case. The death penalty doesn't serve as a deterrent. A study by the Death Penalty Information Center found that the South has consistently had by far the highest murder rate, yet the South accounts for more than 80% of all executions. The Northeast, which has fewer than 0.5% of all executions, has consistently had the lowest murder rate. To discuss the death penalty in America, we've invited Mike Farrell to join us. Mike is the president of Death Penalty Focus, an organization on whose board I have served for many years. Known to millions as BJ Honeycutt on television's historic show MASH, he is also a writer, director, and producer. A human rights activist for over 35 years, Mike has taken part in scores of aid missions and human rights delegations to countries all over the world. Mike has visited prisons and been personally involved in numerous death penalty cases across the United States for over 3 decades. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Mike.
Thanks. Nice to be with you, Steve.
As long as I've known you, your opposition to the death penalty has never been an abstraction. Your activism is traced to people, men and women, you've met inside and outside prison. I understand that while you were filming MASH in the early 1980s, you got a call from Joe Engel at the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons that first launched your work to end capital punishment. Tell us about that call and the impact it had on you.
Sure. Prior to in the 60s, I was part of a halfway house organization that was dealt with people in and out of prisons. And I went into prisons and saw some of the really awful situations that people found themselves in and how inhumane the treatment was. And I'd also always felt that the death penalty made no sense, but I was not particularly an activist. But I guess I signed a petition or made a statement somewhere publicly, and I got a call from Reverend Joe Engel, who ran the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons, right around 1980, saying, I understand you're against the death penalty. And I said, that's right. And he said, in 76, the Supreme Court decision started it up again. We're going to have a bloodbath in this country. I need somebody that can help me get public attention. You're on a television series, and will you work with me? And I said, sure. Actually, he asked first if he could come out to the set and meet, and we did and talked, and that's where he kind of laid it on me that he'd like me to help. And Joe took me to my first death row in Tennessee State Prison. And we walked around and talked to these guys. Some of them were all black and brown. Some were really angry and some frustrated and some terrified and some really quite sweet. And I was obviously very moved by the experience. And so I stayed involved with the Southern Coalition and Joe. And that kind of began the process.
Mike Farrell, I understand it was through Marie Deans, a murder victim's family member in Virginia, that you first became involved in the case of Joe Giarratano. What was it about Joe's case that grabbed your attention and sustained your involvement?
Actually, I'd met Marie through Joe. She was part of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. He asked her to establish the Virginia Coalition on Jails and Prisons, which she did. And she called me one day. I was involved in Central America issues, and she called me, and I was headed to Washington. And she said, "Would you stop in Richmond? I'd like to talk to you." And she wanted me to meet this young man who was on death row in Virginia. His name is Joe Giarratano. She believed him to be innocent. Among the issues in Virginia at that time, they had what they called the 21-day rule, which said that after 21 days after a death penalty conviction, no new evidence could be submitted in the case, which was insane. And she said, the only way we can get this kid a hearing and get him off death row is to go to the governor, and I need a public campaign, and I need you to lead it. So we set up a campaign. He had left home at 11 years of age, a drug and alcohol consumer. His parents, it turns out, were big-time drug dealers. He was working on the waterfront in Virginia and knew two women, a woman and her daughter, and was periodically visited them and sometimes bunked with them. He had blackouts as a result of his addiction, and he woke up from a blackout on the sofa in their apartment to find both of them dead, murdered. He thought he had done it. He must have. He felt he was inherently evil, so he must have done it. He left the building and, of all things, tried to head back to his parents' home. But when he got back to Florida, he said he got off the bus, and the first cop he saw, he walked up and he said, "I think I killed two women in Virginia." And he was immediately arrested, in spite of the fact that there was evidence at the scene pointing to other people. The police had a confession, and they decided that was fine. They arrested him, charged him with murder, and sentenced him to death. So he had been, by that time, many years on death row. And we finally ratcheted up the volume on the case to the point that in 1991, he was to be executed. The day before he was to be executed, we sat with him in the death row, in the execution chamber. and talked about what would happen. I'll never forget it, Joe. We were sitting around a table, and the lawyer said to me, tell Mike what this table is. And Joe said, oh, Mike, after they electrocute me, the guards wearing asbestos gloves will carry my body out and lay it on this table. This is the cooling table. I thought, oh, my God, what world have I come to? Needless to say, the governor acted, took Joe off death row. He said, on the basis of possible innocence, he should serve 25 years in prison before release. And Joe is out now and a contributing member of society.
These stories are so compelling. And this risk of executing innocent people is so real. Tell us about our good friend Gary Tyler's case.
Gary is a classic case. He was on a bus with a bunch of black kids when he was, I think, 17 years old. And the point was to integrate a school in New Orleans. And there was a quite raucous white mob outside stopping the bus, trying to keep the bus from going in and the kids from integrating the school. And a shot was fired. A young white kid fell and died. The bus was emptied. The bus was searched. Nothing was found. The bus kids were talked to. Gary, being big, didn't like the way he was being talked to, and he said so. And that kind of singled him out. And somehow, after having searched the bus and found nothing, some police officer found a gun and said it was in the seat that Gary was sitting in. So Gary was tried, convicted quickly, and sentenced to death. He spent many years on death row. He said the death row, people on death row essentially raised him, schooled him. A few years later, the death penalty was thrown out in Louisiana, so he was transferred, but not released. He spent 43 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, and was finally released as a result of some work by George Kendall, one of the great defense attorneys around the country. George told me that when he walked Gary to the gate, the warden walked with him, and that Gary was such a positive influence in the prison, the warden hated to see him go, and he said the warden had tears in his eyes when he shook their hands and sent Gary on his way. Today, Gary is an active member of society, an artist who's won extraordinary prizes for his work as a quilt artist, and he's become a dear friend of Death Penalty Focus, the organization over which I preside.
Wow. Well, Mike Farrell, almost all of the cases you've been involved with have been plagued by ineffective assistance of counsel. As just one example, tell us about the case of Walter Ogrod.
The issues of IAC, as they call it, ineffective assistance of counsel, is a very real one, particularly in the world of death row. Walter, in his neighborhood in Philadelphia, a child was kidnapped and murdered. And left, it was a horrific crime, left in a cardboard box on a corner in that neighborhood. And there were no clues. The police searched and couldn't find anything. But they discovered Walter Ogrod, who lived across the street from the family whose baby had been stolen, a child had been stolen. And Walter was a slow boy. And when they found out that he had visited the house, that he knew the child, and they decided that he was a likely suspect. So he was charged, ultimately, because they had gone through the search and found no other likely suspect. And he was turned over, his case was turned over to two extraordinarily abusive detectives who berated him and did everything they could to terrify him. And that was not hard to do with Walter, who was quite slow, as I said. I should say, as an aside, there's a wonderful book about Walter Ograd's case written by Tom Lowenstein, the son of Allard Lowenstein, the quite extraordinary former member of Congress and leader of the Dump Johnson movement in 1968. And Tom tells the story quite clearly. Walter was just harassed by these prosecutors until he not only confessed, he added information about what might have happened in such a case, and that he was probably the one who had done it. So when presented with a defense in a situation like that, I think a lawyer has an extraordinary responsibility to not only know who the client is, but also know the history of the case. And in his case, it seems to me that a serious study of the notes, the prosecutor's notes and the interview notes and Walter's confession and all of these things would have said, you just had red flags all over them. But in fact, he was convicted and sentenced to death, and his initial appeals were not successful. And it was not until a lot of attention was brought to the case and a progressive prosecutor came in Philadelphia that Walter's case was, in fact, re-adjudicated. And after God knows how many days, how many years on death row, he was finally released.
Mike, it's already apparent that racism is embedded at all levels of the capital punishment system. In California, where we both live, were it not for the moratorium declared by Governor Gavin Newsom, Kevin Cooper, an African-American death row inmate, could have been executed years ago. Yet recently, Newsom himself rejected a plea to commute Kevin's sentence. Tell us about the case of Kevin Cooper and where it stands.
Yeah, that's a very complicated case. Kevin was arrested in, I think, in 1980, the early 80s. He had escaped from a minimum security prison in San Bernardino County, California, and found refuge in a deserted house in an area wherein the night before, I believe, he found that place, four people were murdered. A man, a woman, and one of their children, and a guest, another child, and one of their other children survived. A hideous crime that was, examination of the scene showed that three weapons had been used, that there was blood all over the place. And it was obviously a terrible, terrible crime that caused great concern in the neighborhoods. And the prosecutors found a single drop of blood that they claim was connected this case to this young man, and who had been in a house 100 yards away after having escaped from prison. Well, a black man who escaped from prison 100 yards away from a hideous murder must be the guy who did the crime. And I remember actually being out there with Jesse Jackson when we were trying to raise attention to the case in a campaign, because the evidence was clearly doctored. Forgive me for the perhaps overstatement, but the evidence looked like it had been tampered with. Many things about the case and the sheriff's investigation and the actual blood evidence itself appears to have been tampered with. Any number of things to show that this man was guilty. And Kevin always assumed or declared his innocence. But when I was out there with Jesse Jackson trying to raise attention about the case, I remember signs talking about fry the N-word, hang the gorilla. I mean, just hideous, hideous, racist campaigns were being run to get this man dead. So the case went in 1994, I believe it was, he was about to be executed. Whichever year it was, the governor at the time was Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he refused to stop the execution. But we, at the last minute, the Ninth Circuit Court stopped the execution and said there was evidence in this case, and a 100-page statement by one of the judges on the circuit said that there is evidence, much evidence, that this man is innocent and that this evidence was supplanted and that there was some really suspicious dealings on the part of the prosecution. So Kevin's case has been batted back and forth for years. He is still alive. He is still in, actually he was in San Quentin on death row. He's been on death row from, I think, 83 until quite recently, when Governor Newsom's new campaign to close death row and move death row inmates out into other prisons has taken place. And Kevin is now in a different prison and not on death row, but still under sentence of death here in California. Governor Newsom, finally, under a good deal of pressure from those of us in the anti-death penalty community, authorized an investigation, a post-conviction investigation of Kevin's case. And it was done by a highly respected firm here in Los Angeles. And I think they did a shoddy job, personally. I think there are outrageous things that are done in the, and as a result, or through this investigation, or lack thereof, in fact, there are many things they didn't look at. Kevin's defense attorneys have written a really incisive response to that report, but unfortunately, Governor Newsom had authorized that report. And when asked, he said that he accepted the result of that initial report, which concluded that Kevin Cooper was guilty. So the fight continues. I think Governor Newsom was wrong, but we will now have to continue the battle to get the facts clear and to get the evidence of Kevin's innocence made known to the point that he will be released. Up until that time, he remains under death penalty here in California.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by co-host Maria Hall, and we're with Mike Farrell talking about the death penalty.
Mike Farrell, we were talking about state politics. Let's talk about the federal level. Donald Trump promises that if he's reelected, he'll execute every one of the 42 men on federal death row, 38% of whom are Black. Joe Biden says he's opposed to the death penalty. And years ago, Attorney General Merrick Garland initiated a study of capital punishment, which has yet to be released. What are the prospects of ending the death penalty at the federal level?
Well, I think the facts speak for themselves. When President Donald Trump and his Attorney General quickly executed 13 men from California, from the federal death row. There hadn't been a federal death execution since, in maybe a dozen years, maybe more. And they decided they were going to show how hard they were, tough they were on crime. So they did this. So Donald Trump's threat that he will execute everybody on the federal death row is, I think, credible and ugly and will be taken advantage of if he is elected. President Biden has found, I think, the truth about the death penalty, has ultimately, during the campaign, stated his opposition to the death penalty, which is appreciated. Merrick Garland is, as you said, has initiated an investigation on the part of the Justice Department into the federal system, which I think stinks. But the fact is that political pressure, in my opinion, is what has kept President Biden from making good on his stated opposition to the death penalty and commuting the sentences of those on the federal death row, and encouraging, as he said he would, other states to follow that procedure and re-examine their death penalty. So we have a terrible situation, and it's larded with political concerns, and I think nothing will happen until the election in terms of any kind of action about the federal death penalty. And the results of the election will determine whether or not we in the United States kill a great number of people who are on federal death row, or President Biden, if reelected, may find the political winds such that he is willing to act on his stated concern about the death penalty and commute those people to life rather than committing them to death.
Mike, as we come to the close, we're so grateful you joined us today. We're even more grateful for the work you do every day to end capital punishment. What can our listeners do to confront and end this barbaric form of punishment? And tell us about how they can reach Death Penalty Focus and what actions they can take.
Sure. I hope people all over the country are listening to this and will do what they can in their own states to put pressure on, support governors who have taken the extraordinary, our governors and the legislatures that have taken the extraordinary steps to do away with the death penalty, support those governors in three or four states who have declared moratoria, as has Governor Newsom here in California. And I think Governor DeWine in Ohio would be one who might do that. But Death Penalty Focus, the organization of which I'm president of the board, can be reached at deathpenalty.org, I believe it is. Anybody who wants information about what we do, how to get involved, get information about the death penalty, not only here in California, but in other states, we're happy to provide as much information as anyone needs. Obviously, we need the support. It's a non-governmental organization. We need the support of people who are listening to continue our work. And I think we will succeed in doing away with the death penalty here in California. But we have a lot of work in a number of the states, 27, I believe, that still have a death penalty, even though, as I said, three or four of them have a moratoria on the death system. But it's urgently important that people understand that the death system as it is practiced in this country is, as one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence said, brutalizes everyone associated with the process. And by that he didn't mean just the executioners or just the judge or the jury. It means all of us. We are all brutalized by having and practicing this awful system that takes the lives of human beings who could otherwise be in some cases rehabilitated, in other cases simply kept safe from society.
Thank you, Mike, and good luck and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIFFM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, 90.7 FM.
WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our streaming planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN-LP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR-LP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJP LP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.